I was pretty shocked that it would, I guess, come out the way that it came out. It was hard to hear coming from the tweet.
An Alaskan transgender Air Force staff sergeant reacts to the president's announcement saying he'll ban transgender people from the military. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, reaction to the proposed capital budget plan that would cut funds for the Juneau Road project.
Taking any funding away from that that would jeopardize it moving forward is not a good thing in the state's best interest.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This afternoon, the U.S. Senate voted against an amendment to partially repeal the Affordable Care Act with no replacement. Seven Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski, joined Democrats in opposing the measure. It was one of several votes concerning the health care law in 2 days, following yesterday's narrow Senate vote to allow debate on repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. President Donald Trump tweeted his disapproval toward Senator Lisa Murkowski, stating that she, quote, let the Republicans and our country down. Murkowski and Susan Collins of Maine were the only Republican senators to vote no on the measure, causing a 50-50 split that required a tie-breaking vote from Vice President Mike Pence. In an interview with MSNBC today, Murkowski said she isn't very concerned about the president's tweet or how it affects her political future.
I don't think it's wise to be operating on a daily basis thinking about what a statement or a response that causes you to be fearful of your electoral prospects. We're here to govern.
Murkowski reminded the reporter that she isn't up for re-election until 2022. She voted against today's partial repeal amendment, while Senator Dan Sullivan voted in support of the amendment. This morning, the president declared that transgender individuals will no longer be allowed to serve in the U.S. military, but thousands already do. That includes service members based in Alaska. I spoke with Air Force Staff Sergeant Emma Horner, who came out as transgender to her fellow military members in October when the Department of Defense released a policy saying it would accept openly transgender people and help them transition. Horner says that coming out was a positive experience.
Honestly, I've become more confident in what I do. For me, it's been only good things as far as my career goes so far.
Did it change your job at all?
As far as my job goes, I did get a different job just because I was away for medical things here and there. However, I love the position that I'm in now. I feel like I do more there than out on the flight line itself. So,
how did people that you work with, other military service members, react when you did come out?
Honestly, I didn't get much of a real reaction, I guess. I was kind of away on vacation after I officially came out, and which was in October, whenever everything was starting to really change. So, but as soon as I got back to work, nobody really, addressed it too much. I had a few people come up and ask me questions, which was a surprise to me, being in a male-dominated career field. That was kind of a pleasant surprise as far as it goes.
How about the military structure? You mentioned that other service members asked you how you were treated by the larger structure of the Air Force. What was that like?
I mean, it was hard. There's a lot of roadblocks for us to overcome that to me seemed unnecessary. However, according to the military, they were necessary things to do. I was able to get approval for, I was already on hormones, but to get my gender marker changed, I was actually the first person on JBR to get that done, as far as the Air Force side goes, which was a exciting day, which meant that I could go by female standards now, and I don't have to use male restrooms or anything like that, so, which was very exciting for me.
The announcement today from the president, what did you think when you found out that President Trump intends to ban transgender people from the military?
I was pretty shocked that it would, I guess, come out the way that it came out. It was hard to hear coming from, you know, I guess a tweet and to hear that my job and so many of my transgender military brothers and sisters could be, you know, out of a job, out of serving a country that we love and we want to take care of and be there for and in the hardest of times.
What's the thing that's most concerning you about this announcement right now?
I guess just the fact that there's so many people who, I mean, this was, you know, what they wanted to do their whole lives, you know, was join the military and serve their country. And the fact that those people are up for, you know, being, you know, kicked out. There's a lot of fear of the unknown at this point.
I know you've only had just part of a day to really think about this, but how will it affect you and what will you do now?
That's kind of hard to say at this point. Only have a couple more months before I'm scheduled to get out of the military, as far as active duty goes anyway. I was planning on going National Guard after my time was up here because my son's up here and I wanted to make sure that I could still be with him. I mean, that's not, you know, something that I can do anymore. And even though the job that I do now is something that they're needing people to do it, so I guess we'll see what happens.
That was Air Force Staff Sergeant Emma Horner talking about the president's new ban on transgender military members. State lawmakers are scheduled to vote tomorrow on a capital budget that will include $20 million in oil and gas tax credits. It would also add money to assist municipalities and to complete a school in Kivalina. Those are among the details released today on the capital budget for the fiscal year that started at the beginning of July. Lawmakers plan to spend as little as one day in Juneau as they meet for their third special session this year. The legislature is scheduled to gavel in at 11 a.m. A conference committee plans to meet on the capital budget early in the afternoon, and both the Senate and House could pass it later in the day. Associated General Contractors of Alaska Executive Director John McKinnon says it's important for the legislature to act.
All in all, I'm very pleased that we're going to get a capital budget. To have a year without a capital budget, we're foregoing, you know, $1.3, $1.4 billion in federal funds.
McKinnon overstated it a bit. It's actually $1,180,000,000 in federal funds. McKinnon's wife is Eagle River Republican State Senator Anna McKinnon. She's been negotiating the capital budget with Nome Democratic Representative Neil Foster. At less than $1.5 billion, it will be the smallest capital budget since 2000. Most of the funding is from the federal government. This capital budget could affect a long-proposed mega project in Juneau by moving money out of a major road extension toward other projects. Juneau Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Craig Dahl opposes the changes.
Taking any funding away from that would jeopardize it moving forward is not a good thing in the state's best interest.
Governor Bill Walker decided against pursuing the Juneau Access Road last year, but project supporters continue to push for it. The capital budget agreement doesn't include $700 million that the House had passed to restore permanent fund dividends to the full amount set by state law. Instead of a projected $2,300, dividends will be $1,100 per Alaskan. The capital budget agreement also includes funds for the Arctic Strategic Transportation and Resources Project. It's intended to improve transportation in 9 North Slope borough communities. The $20 million for oil and gas tax credits will be added to $57 million for credits in the operating budget enacted in June. That brings the total to the minimum suggested by state law. It's not clear whether whether there will be a fourth special session later this year to pass a plan Walker proposed to balance the state's budget in the long term. The FBI is investigating the death of a 39-year-old Utah woman who died aboard the Emerald Princess cruise ship in southeast Alaska. According to a statement by Princess Cruises, the woman was involved in a domestic dispute that occurred about 9 p.m. on Wednesday. Today, the ship is moored in Juneau at the South Franklin Street dock. The woman's name has not been released. The cruise line's release says Fleet Security is coordinating with the FBI and other local authorities. The FBI is investigating the incident because the death occurred in U.S. waters outside of state territory. According to the release, the Emerald Princess is on a 7-day round-trip cruise that departed Seattle on July 23rd. Alaska State Troopers and the FBI's Juneau Division referred inquiries to the Anchorage FBI office, which did not respond to requests for comment by deadline. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, understanding the cycle of boom and bust for bugs.
We sometimes get years with very little of certain species and then huge outbreaks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on August 1st from 5 to 6:30 p.m. in the Mendenhall Valley Public Library in Juneau. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
Coast Guard personnel based out of Kotzebue helped rescue six people Monday in two emergency operations in northwest Alaska. A Coast Guard news release says the first operation began late Monday morning with a call from Alaska State Troopers for help rescuing four people who were reportedly aboard a small disabled vessel that was adrift in a lagoon about 150 miles southwest of Kotzebue. A crew flying a Coast Guard MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter located the four stranded on the south shore of the Imrook Lagoon, near where they'd managed to run their 18-foot skiff aground after its engine malfunctioned. The air crew landed on the beach, checked on the condition of the boat passengers, and waited until a volunteer search and rescue crew from Brevik Mission arrived. On Monday evening, a second MH-60 Jayhawk crew joined a search and rescue operation to locate two people reported missing on a trip from Point Hope to Kivalina. The air crew located the two in a cabin about 26 miles south of Point Hope. They were later evacuated by North Slope Search and Rescue and Ground Search Team personnel. According to the news release, the two operations show how the Coast Guard's forward-deployed contingent in Kotzebue can coordinate with state and local agencies and respond quickly during Arctic search and rescues. Forward operating location Kotzebue consists of two MH-60 Jayhawks from Air Station Kodiak, along with air and ground crews based out of the Alaska Army National Guard hangar in Kotzebue. The aircraft and personnel will remain in Kotzebue through Coast Guard Arctic Shield 2017, an Arctic field training exercise that runs through the summer. Alaskans have only about a week left to tell the Marine Highway System what they think of its fall, winter, and spring sailing plans. The schedule, which is similar to last year's, came out later than usual, and the comment period is shorter, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Last year, the fall-winter-spring ferry schedule was released in May. Residents had about a month to go through it and provide feedback. This year, it wasn't made available till mid-July, with a comment deadline 2 weeks later. Marine Highway General Manager Captain John Falvey says that's because the legislature took through most of June to pass a spending plan.
Well, we can't put schedules out to comment on until we have a final budget figure, so being that we were running a little bit late this year, we just got a late start.
He says the ferry system wants a fast turnaround so it can begin taking reservations during the first week of August. Written comments on the schedule are due by July 30th, and a teleconference will be held the following day. Marine Transportation Advisory Board Chairman Robert Venables doesn't see that as a problem.
that is a shorter public review and comment period, but I think most folks are very familiar with the schedule and the system and their needs, so it's best to get that schedule published and open for reservations.
One reason he's not worried is that the schedule is very much like the previous years. Falvey says a few sailings have been added, but not many.
Operating week's about the same overall. Budget's about the same overall. What you saw last year is about what you're going to see this year overall, and a little bit of a different switch on the ships.
That's due to lengthy repairs to the Ferry Columbia, which usually sails between Southeast and Bellingham, Washington. It's been out of service since last September due to a damaged propeller system.
Most parts don't exist. It's all 1973 vintage. And over the winter, that entire system had to be rebuilt in Germany, and we're still not there yet.
The draft fall schedule shows the Columbia resuming service October 1st, but Falvey says that's now pushed back about a month. Other ships will fill in. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Work began this week on a project to widen a stretch of the Richardson Highway at the south gate of Eielson Air Force Base. The project also will add turn lanes for the gate. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the work will slow traffic through the area for the next 2 months.
45 miles per hour construction zone signs are up and work is underway around Eielson's South Gate on a project intended to make it easier for workers and equipment to get to their construction sites on base. But State Transportation Department spokeswoman Caitlin Fry says motorists should expect longer delays through the area within a couple of weeks.
Most of the activity that is going to affect drivers is going to be from early to mid-August to about mid-September. That's when there will be periods where drivers can expect to see flaggers and pilot cars and a few more delays.
Fry says Fairbanks-based Exclusive Paving is working on the nearly $1.4 million project that's intended to ease access to sites on base where construction is underway on new facilities to accommodate two squadrons of new generation F-35 fighters and personnel.
After the project is done, drivers will see a new left turn pocket heading in the southbound direction, and there will also be a right turn pocket heading north.
Eielson officials say the south gate will be used only by contractors and other construction-related vehicles and equipment during the $500 million F-35 buildup. The officials expect the two squadrons will bring some 1,250 additional personnel to the base beginning in 2020. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A green sponge discovered in 2005 in Southeast Alaska waters has unique properties that could be used to treat certain types of cancer. KRBD's Layla Carey listened in on a news conference this morning, hosted by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Bob Stone is a Juneau-based coral and sponge biologist with NOAA Fisheries, but he works all over Alaska's oceans. He was in a submersible conducting habitat surveys off Baranof Island south of Sitka when he saw it.
And the second I saw it, I thought that I should collect it. I didn't know what it was. I like to collect anything that I'm not familiar with.
It was a green sponge, unusual for the region where sponges are more of a brownish color. Stone says it looked like some sponges he'd been collecting in the Aleutians for Mark Heyman, a cancer researcher for the Medical University of South Carolina. Those Aleutian sponges contain potentially useful biomedical compounds, and Stone says he suspected this one might too.
And as it turned out, this was an undescribed species of sponge, but in the same genus as the ones from the Aleutian Islands.
Sponges don't move, so to survive, they produce special compounds that help ward off predators. And according to NOAA, some of those compounds can be developed for human medical treatments. Another cancer researcher, Fred Valerio of the Detroit-based Henry Ford Cancer Institute, says he investigates natural products for potential treatments and has collaborated with Heyman in the past. Valerio says Heyman's lab studied the chemical diversity of that green sponge and then sent an extract to the Detroit lab for them to take a look.
And we found that this extract had selective activity in our tissue culture system for both pancreatic cancer and ovarian cancer.
That means the extract appears to target and kill tumor cells for those types of cancer without also hurting normal cells. This is huge because those slow-growing cancers don't typically respond to conventional treatments such as chemotherapy. The next step is to obtain more of the green sponge's special cancer-killing molecule. Collecting more sponges is one option, but challenging because of their limited habitat. The sponge's known range is about 1,000 miles from southeast Alaska toward the waters off Washington State. Here's Heyman.
Not only is the sponge relatively rare, then it turns out that the molecule is actually in very small quantities in the sponge.
So Heyman is working on synthesizing the molecule in the lab. Heyman says this discovery is exciting. He's been doing this kind of research for more than two decades.
This is certainly, for us, the best and most exciting looking candidate for the control of pancreatic cancer that we've come across in that 20-year period.
The unique molecule likely developed in the sponge in response to its habitat. The development process takes time, so although it's looking good, it'll be a while before we know for sure whether a relatively rare green sponge from Alaska will help save human lives. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Bugs of various shapes and sizes are part of life in Alaska, and it can be easy for them to escape notice. KTNA's Philip Manning recently spoke with an entomology expert about some recent trends in Alaskan arthropods.
Anecdotally, this year seems light on one of Alaska's most prolific insects, the mosquito. Despite the fact that Alaska is home to nearly 40 species of the insect, there just don't seem to be as many around as in some years. To find out more, I spoke with Derek Sykes, Associate Professor of Entomology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Insect Curator at the Museum of the North. He says populations of various types of bugs can vary widely from year to year.
The population cycles of some insects are really dramatic in Alaska. We sometimes get years with very little of seeing certain species and then huge outbreaks.
While the specific causes for each boom or bust of bugs aren't often known, Derek Sykes says there are some general rules.
When it's a wet spring and it's lots of rain during the summer, you expect to have a lot more mosquitoes because they're aquatic insects. They need standing water for their larvae to develop. Conversely, a dry summer is usually very good for yellow jackets.
This year's a little odd, says Sykes, since both mosquito and yellow jacket populations seem to be low. One type of insect that does not seem to have population issues this year is Alaska's 20-plus native species of bumblebee. Derek Sykes says that sets Alaska apart from much of the lower 48.
Research found that bumblebees are moving northward on the southern parts of their range, but they're not moving northward on the northern parts of their range. So their range is just shrinking.
One type of bug whose increased presence is more concerning is ticks. Derek Sykes says Alaska's home to seven native tick species, though most people are unlikely to encounter them.
We've always had ticks. They've been on the snowshoe hares and on the seabirds and some other wildlife. But those native ticks almost never interact with people and our pets.
The potential problem is with ticks not native to Alaska that can and do feed on dogs and humans. Derek Sykes says recent research has shown that there are American dog ticks present in Alaska. While that's not unusual for animals who have been outside of the state, he says it's concerning that some animals who have not left the area have become hosts to the invasive ticks.
What that means is we have evidence of ticks on dogs that have no travel history, meaning these ticks got onto the dog from Alaskan vegetation, and they were probably breeding in Alaska and are establishing.
Derek Sykes advises that anyone traveling outside of Alaska with pets take precaution to prevent bringing ticks back home. In addition, he says it may become necessary in the future for Alaskan pet owners to take preventative measures for the parasites, even for pets who will never leave the state. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
In other parts of the country, the temperature on a perfect summer day might land somewhere in the mid-80s. In most of Alaska, though, the mid-70s are a more realistic target. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with Brian Brettschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. He told editor Annie Feit that Juneau has had very few days above 70 this summer. In contrast, Anchorage logged its warmest temperature of the year on Sunday.
76 degrees. It had been 75 on June 1st. And that's actually typical that normally the warmest temperature in any given year for Anchorage is 76. So if we don't have any warmer day, then we'll be right on pace for that tally.
So what's normal for the number of days above 70 degrees around Alaska?
Well, 70 is kind of a magic number. It's kind of a threshold that everyone keeps track of. So for Anchorage, about 14 to 15 days per year where we're going to hit 70. Juneau, it's a little bit higher. It's up to about 20 days a year, exactly 20. But then once you get to the interior, those numbers jump way up. Fairbanks, it's about 55 days a year. And then once you get to Nome and Kotzebue, it's about 5 days a year.
And what have we had so far?
Well, here in Anchorage, we're up to 9 70-degree days through this last weekend. And that's just a little bit below where we should be for the season. We should have had about 10. And then we should have about, on average, about 4 more per year. So we're pretty much right on track. And if we have a warm week, we can blow past the average annual total. So we're right in where we should be.
And are there outliers in the state, though?
Well, as there always is, you know, there are winners and there are losers, as it were. Down in Southeast, they're actually having a little bit cooler than normal summer. Juneau's about a degree and a half below normal for the summer. And their 70-degree days are far below normal. So they should have had 13 through July 24th, 25th. And they're actually only at 3, which is really low. The lowest they've ever had in any season is 2. So if they don't have another one, they'll only miss that mark by 1 day. So they're not basking in the warmth that most of the rest of the state has periodically had this summer.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate and climate change in the state. If you have a question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can find us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Feit, Wesley Early, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman, Trip Krause, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.